Everyone. Okay, the first case of the day is Appeal 10-1383, Federal Trade Commission versus Trudeau. And it's Mr. Anderson. Good morning, Mr. Anderson. You know, forgive me, if everyone moves in a little, the people that are standing at the back could actually sit down. See, that wasn't hard, was it? Great. Okay.
Good morning again. May it please the Court. We're dealing today with the issues of whether Mr. Trudeau's out-of-court radio solicitation or encouragement to his supporters to send emails to the district court can constitute criminal conduct under 18 U.S.C. Section 401, and also the issue of whether the district court could summarily punish and sentence that conduct under Rule 42, Federal Rules of Criminal Procedure, without really any kind of notice, any kind of opportunity to defend, without the presumption of innocence, and really without any trial of any kind. And in summary, Section 401, which defines contemptuous behavior substantively, sets forth three statutory elements under Section 401, subparagraph 1, and all of those elements are missing from this record here below. There was no misbehavior in the presence of the court. There was no actual obstruction of the administration of justice, and there was no criminal intent to do so. And as the statute makes clear, very emphatically, the criminal contempt includes misbehavior that meets all of these requirements, end quote, and none other, end quote. So Congress was very emphatic that the judiciary's contempt power would be expressly limited to these elements and none other. And similarly, I think it's important to recognize that Rule 42 is the procedural side of contempt. It prescribes the procedures for prosecuting allegedly contemptuous behavior. And Rule 42B, which the district court relied on below, allows summary prosecution and sentencing only in the very limited circumstance where the misbehavior occurred in the presence of the court and where the district court judge certifies that he or she saw or heard the conduct. And that that did not happen here today.
Sorry. Mr. Anderson, what do you think would be gained by a procedure under Rule 42A in a case where the defendant admits all of the essential facts of the contempt? I mean, there's no doubt that, or there seems to be no doubt that Mr. Trudeau was personally responsible for causing others to submit evidence wholly outside what we consider the normal discovery process, directly to the court, and in such an overwhelming fashion that it took down the court's electronic communications. If he admits he did it, why not use the summary procedure?
Well, for several reasons. And first of all, I think that there are some factual inaccuracies in your description of the record, with all due respect.
Never.
First of all, the statute requires an actual obstruction of justice. It requires intent to do so, and it requires misconduct in the presence of the court. And none of those elements are present here, let alone being admitted by the defendant.
Well, he did intend, by his own message, to direct the information right at the judge, didn't he? I mean, that's in his radio broadcast.
He did encourage his solicitors to contact the judge directly, but there is certainly no evidence that he had any intent to obstruct the administration of justice. That's a very narrow term, and it's been addressed by this court and the United States Supreme Court to mean the actual obstruction of a judge doing his or her official duties, and that certainly didn't happen here.
But he did intend to get as many emails as he could drum up from his radio broadcast and from his email blast, however many that might be.
Well, I don't know that that was his intent. There's really no evidence on that, but I can tell you what is in the record about the effect on the judge, which was nothing that comes close to the obstruction of the administration of justice. There was no court proceedings halted. There were no servers failed. No computer systems failed. There was no...
That was just good luck, perhaps, in this case.
Or he's not as popular as he thought he was.
Yes.
Well, whatever it was, there was no obstruction of justice. And similarly, you can't look at this record and conclude beyond a reasonable doubt that there was any intent to obstruct the administration of justice. An equally plausible view of it is he was attempting to aid in the administration of justice, although perhaps in a misguided way. But he certainly didn't think or couldn't, on this record, could not have believed that he was going to shut down any systems. First of all, he didn't. Second of all, he encouraged all of his supporters to copy himself on it. So he would not have done that assuming it was going to crash his own system. But the fact of it is, it didn't crash any system. It didn't interrupt any court proceeding. It doesn't meet any of the benchmarks for the obstruction of justice.
I'm sorry for interrupting, but didn't Judge Gettleman say that it brought a halt to his ability to get to his email and he had to have their IT people come in to clear something out and have the marshals review for security threats?
Here's what he said. He said it effectively shut him down, and then he amplified and explained what he meant. When he went off to teach his law course at the University of Northwestern Law Clinic, his BlackBerry was buzzing repeatedly. And then he said when he got back to the court, he asked the IT staff to come in and set up a folder which automatically diverted the emails so that he would not see them popping up on his BlackBerry. That's what he explained, and he used the words effectively shut down. But I think the reality is that there were no servers crashed, no access to records blocked, no interruption of any court proceeding. And those are all the benchmarks that the United States Supreme Court and this court has identified for what constitutes an actual obstruction of the administration of justice. A mere interruption or merely making more work for the court doesn't reach that threshold.
Would you concede that it would be possible to bring the charge of contempt for this kind of behavior under Rule 42A? Because if not, what recourse would a judge have when a party ignored all of the rules for discovery and solicited third parties to submit evidence directly to the court?
Okay, well, let me answer really two questions. First of all, does this conduct fall within the ambit of Section 401 of Article 18? The answer to that is no, and I'll explain why. And the second question is, what recourse does the judge have? And let me address that as too. This does not fall within the ambit of Section 401 because the statute has been construed by the United States Supreme Court in the Nye case and the Wilson case to require a physical geographic limitation. And you can read Nye, I'm sure you have, and it explains the historical reason for that, Congress's delimitation of the judiciary's contempt power. And it was because Congress perceived that the judiciary, the lower courts, were abusing their power. And so they wrote in basically a physical geographic limitation. And Congress then, of course, amended the act and reenacted it in 2002 and is presumed to have adopted that Supreme Court construction of a physical proximity requirement. So the answer to your question, Judge Roedner, is no. This kind of conduct, which did not occur in any kind of physical proximity to the court, falls outside the ambit of Section 401.
Well, would you concede that the consequences of Mr. Trudeau's actions was felt in the court, and the judge saw or heard it by accessing the offending statements and reading the emails?
Well, that's right. That's the fruits of the conduct may have been observed by the court,
by Judge Gettleman, but the fruits of the conduct are different from the conduct themselves, and that was made very clear by the United States Supreme Court in Nye, where the defendant encouraged others to write letters to the court. And you may recall that the Supreme Court in Nye said it is inconsequential for contempt purposes that the judge received and read the letters in court, because the conduct occurred outside the presence of the court. And that's a critical distinction that the Supreme Court in Nye and in Wilson made, and it's one that's apparent from the plain language of the statute, which requires in the presence of court. Now, I haven't answered your second question yet, but I don't want to interrupt your train of thought.
My train of thought goes on forever.
Okay. Well, your second question was, if 401 doesn't cover it, what recourse do they have? Well, Section 401 is not an omnibus crime act. There are many other statutes in Article 18 that potentially cover conduct. Now, I'm not saying it would cover Mr. Trudeau's conduct, but look at 18 U.S.C. Section 1030. That criminalizes basically cyber attacks intended to damage or interrupt the government's computers. There's another statute. None of these emails were threatening in our view, but there's another statute, 18 U.S.C. 575, that criminalizes threats to injure another person. So there is a whole panoply of federal criminal statutes that would address, you know, the hypothetical horrible that I think you had in mind, Judge Roedner, but is not really present here. Section 401 is not an omnibus crime act. The Congress and the United States Supreme Court have made it clear it's limited to very, very narrow circumstances, quote, and none other. My light is on, but I want to make one other point about Rule 42B, if I may.
Of course.
Because Rule 42 prescribes procedurally how we treat misconduct that could rise to the level of criminal contempt. And Judge Gettleman treated this under Rule 42B, which, pursuant to its plain language, literal language, allows summary disposition only when the misconduct occurs in the presence of the court and when the judge certifies that he or she saw or heard it. And note that the language that we see in 401 about so there near to and, or so there near to is not present in Rule 42B. So even conduct that could be punished criminally as oh so there near to falls out of the purview of Rule 42B. And the district court just made that mistake, because if you look at the district court's contempt order entered on February 17th of 2010, you can see that that the district court says that Trudeau's conduct was, quote, so near thereto as to obstruct the administration of justice, end quote. Well, even if that were factually true, it puts it outside the purview of Rule 42B, which doesn't have the oh so near to language that we see in Section 401. I hope I made that clear.
One quick record point.
Take your time, because we'll give you more time. Don't
yes,
worry.
Hopefully we'll get some more time. What's the state of the case? It was ramping up to a damage hearing, I think, wasn't it? Sometime in March?
Yes. We've been here before on this case, and the Seventh Circuit remanded it for further hearings on the remedy, the financial remedy portion of the case. And that's what we were doing. We were briefing the financial remedy part of the case, and the judge had that, largely under consideration. And, we had some debate about whether additional discovery would be allowed or would be necessary. So that's the stage of the case.
So it's right where it was the day this incident took place.
Yes, yes.
It has not progressed beyond that.
No, we had one further appearance before Judge Gettleman after the Seventh Circuit granted our motion for stay and granted expedited review. And at that one hearing, the judge heard oral argument on the remedies issues, but no decision has been issued. So that's the state of the case right now.
I have one question in regard to previous statement that you made. And that is, if a court is holding a hearing via a Skype connection, would the conduct of a participant in that Skype session be in the presence of the court?
Yeah, well, that is an unresolved question, and it may be one that Congress would like to address as a matter of policy and as a matter of looking at new technology, but I can tell you what the answer is under the existing statute and the existing Supreme Court authority, Nye and Wilson. I think the answer is no, because there's no physical geographic proximity in that situation. You may say, well, that's a bad result, but Congress has said that the court's contempt power is limited to those expressly described situations and none other.
So this situation is no different from the Skype situation, in your view?
I think Mr. Trudeau's situation is even more attenuated than the Skype situation, because in the hypothesis that you've articulated, the defendant is directly and immediately communicating with the court in an unmediated fashion, in an unfiltered fashion. Here, Mr. Trudeau's conduct is really attenuated. He's not communicating directly with the court at all. He's communicating with his supporters, who are then emailing with the judge, and that is a means of communication that can be mediated, at least, and can be administratively handled, in distinction from the Skype situation that you've described. But either scenario, in my view, does not meet the statutory limitation and the United States Supreme Court's construction of that statutory limitation.
I guess you would also say that the computer is not an extension of the judge's persona, then. Because
I think
it seemed to be there was some implication that because of the, we'll call it dependence, that some, not me because I'm not good enough, but some of the extension that some have as far as BlackBerry or computer, that everything they do is through that, and then sort of an attack, if we will, or invasion on the computer is different than the judge, I guess you would say.
I think you have to look at every situation, but at least in this situation, Judge Gettleman, conceded this wasn't a cyber attack. If it was a cyber attack, it would be separately punishable under another statute, and I think I may have identified that statute.
I'm talking about the emails it received.
The emails.
Uttered, et cetera, that it's not like, I guess, it's if one were to argue it, it's like if someone confronts the judge or gets in his face or something, as opposed to confronting his computer with emails.
Oh, that's right. At the heart of this, it goes to the dignity of the court. And when someone is confronting the court by email, there's no public affront to the dignity of the court. Where, in contrast, if I'm standing here misbehaving in front of all of you, there is an immediate public affront to the dignity of the court. So I think the distinction that you're making is logical and well-founded, and I think that you see that and that distinction in the Supreme Court decisions here, which have said basically this kind of summary punishment has been strictly limited to situations where people misbehave in front of the judge. They haul off and hit a witness. They abuse the judge. They interrupt the court proceedings. It has never been extended to this kind of out-of-court conduct, never been extended in a case that's been affirmed by the U.S. Supreme Court. The court's been very clear to caution the lower courts about the summary use of criminal contempt power.
Of course, we're in a new world. There's no question that we're in a new world. We talk about the Nye case. We're talking about the 1940s. Do you in any way, shape, or form think that you may be underestimating the enormous amount of resources that go into assessing possible threats to judges?
I hope I'm not underestimating it, but and I realize it's a serious concern both for the judiciary and members of Congress and the President of the United States. But let's stop and reflect that if someone threatens sends a threatening email to the President of the United States that requires him to get off the podium and do a threat assessment, that person gets due process. They get notice of an indictment. They may be arrested immediately, but they at least get notice of an indictment. They get a trial. It has to be proved beyond a reasonable doubt. They get a trial by jury. There's no policy reason why judges should get any kind of special summary powers be up and over and above the President of the United States or members of Congress.
Do you realize where you are? Thank you, Mr.
I apologize for that comment, but I also want to comment on your historical observation about Nye being, you know, in the 1940s and Wilson in 75. That's the point that the amicus brief makes, but I don't think it's persuasive because in the 1940s and in 1975, we certainly had telephone, we had radio, we had ways to communicate with the judiciary virtually or remotely, and the Supreme Court by letters, which was the subject of the United States Supreme Court decision in Nye. And so I think that given that historical precedent, there's no basis for distinguishing. And then we get to 2002. Congress amended Section 401 to make clear that district courts had the power both to fine and to imprison, but they left in place the Supreme Court's construction and admonition about expanding the court's judiciary power. And the Supreme Court has said repeatedly, and most recently last year in the Forest Grove decision, that when Congress reenacts a statute without altering a Supreme Court or judicial construction of it, they are presumed to know and adopt and assume are assumed to have adopted that construction. So surely in 2002 we've got a Congress aware of how the court has construed it, and we've got email traffic. So I think this historical distinction is not really persuasive.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you.
Now, we're going to give you your rebuttal time, and will you, Marshall Bryan, will you add that much time to Mr. Feinerman's time, please? Thank you. Thank you.
Okay, thank you.
May it please the court, Mr. Anderson, I'm Gary Feinerman of Sidley Austin. I was appointed as amicus to defend the district court judgment in this case. Let me start with Judge Rovner, your first question, which asked whether Mr. Trudeau had violated a court order by asking his fans and followers to send emails directly to the district judge's inbox dealing with consumer harm, which was an issue in the civil remedy proceedings following this court's remand. And I think the court and Mr. Anderson might have been talking past each other, because I think your question, Judge Rovner, dealt with Section 401(3), which concerns violating a court order. And I think Mr. Anderson was answering that under Section 401(1), which was the obstruction of justice. So I'm going to start with 401(3), and let me preface this by saying...
And while you do, maybe you can let me know if you know of any cases under 401(3) where the contemnor did not have actual notice of the... court's order.
I'm not aware of any case where the contemnor did not have actual notice of the court's order. The question here, though, is whether Judge Gettleman abused his discretion or whether any reasonable fact finder in Judge Gettleman's shoes could have found that Mr. Trudeau had notice of the December 22nd order.
But if Mr. Trudeau was not personally present in court on that day in December to hear the judge talking about not taking more discovery, would you take that into consideration when you answer?
It makes it a circumstantial case, but there's an extremely strong circumstantial case.
But did Judge Gettleman focus on whether Mr. Trudeau had notice of this discovery closure order that you've described.
He did, and that's on pages 55 to 56 of the big appendix. The court found that, Judge Gettleman, looking at all the facts and the circumstances, found as a factual matter, based upon the evidence that was before him, that this was a deliberate end run by Kevin Trudeau around the December 22nd order.
But what did he find about what Mr. Trudeau knew of this order as it's been described?
I think it's implicit in his finding of a deliberate end run. In order for it to be a deliberate end run, Mr. Trudeau had to have known about the order in the first place. And let me spend a couple moments laying out why there is an extremely strong circumstantial case.
And when you do, can you explain to us what the urgency was that required Judge Gettleman to act in the summary fashion?
Would you like me to address the circumstantial case first, or I could address that?
I'm actually more interested in the question I just asked.
Okay.
But we do have Judge Roebner's question on the table, too, so we're loading up on you here.
Okay, let me address your question. Why was there an immediate need? And the reason is that the court at that point was under attack. NRA trial, which is this court's last word on criminal contempt, said that immediate action is required under Rule 42B.
But it also said that in a close call, you give the full array of procedures.
This was not a close call. What Trout said was, quote, that immediate action is required where, quote, an immediate function of the court is threatened, end quote. An immediate function of the court is threatened. And Judge Gettleman made a finding that an immediate function of the court was threatened. He said at page 61 of the big appendix, quote, time is of the essence, end quote, given, quote, the court's need to protect itself against this kind of thing. And that finding is owed deference, as this court found in United States versus Lowry.
But at that point, the IT people had shuttled the stuff off to another folder. Trudeau had stopped the process. The emails, there was a clear awareness that it was not to be done.
If that were the law, then contempt could never be punished criminally because a litigant or a lawyer could stand up and swear, and the judge could say, "You stop it," and the litigant say, "Okay, I will. I promise I will not do it again."
But the prior act could still be punished.
And that's exactly what we have here. The prior act, it was being punished. There was a large volume of emails that, A, messed up Judge Gettleman's communication system. He said it essentially shut it down. He couldn't communicate. And I think a court's computer in this day and age is really part and parcel of the court itself and essential to the function. The court's security was at stake. Not only did we have a large volume of emails, but a number of the emails were threatening, and we quoted some of the threatening ones on pages 9 and 10 of our brief. And, one of them actually went so far as to say, we are watching you, and one of them said, wow, what a price you all will someday pay for going out of your way to destroy someone who is clearly helping the lives of so many others. And that statement was preceded by this sentence, Lord have mercy on all your souls. This is at page 163 of the big appendix. Lord have mercy on all your souls for trying to silence us all who truly are out there for others. Now, we all know where the phrase Lord have mercy on all your souls comes from. And is it possible to give an innocent construction to this statement? Yeah, I suppose it's possible. But in this day and age, given what's going on, it would have been reckless and irresponsible for Judge Gettleman to take this as anything other than a threat. And the marshal was called in, and of course judges aren't experts on this, the marshal is. The marshal immediately initiated a threat assessment. So in terms of why immediate action was necessary, you had not just a huge volume of emails that essentially shut down the court's communication system, you had an actual threats being made to the court. If that doesn't require immediate action, I don't know what does. And again, Judge Gettleman found that immediate action was required, and that finding is owed deference under Lowry. Immediate action was also required in order to restore the court's communication system, to get the IT staff in order to divert the emails. So I think that's all I'm going to say on your question. Let me go back to Judge Rovner's question, which is how did Kevin Trudeau know what was going on here? Or could Judge Gettleman have reasonably found that Trudeau knew about the December 22nd order and deliberately violated it? And here I'm going to put what happened in context. At the December 3rd hearing, Judge Gettleman, the court had just received, or a couple months ago had received, the opinion of this court in FTC versus Trudeau. And Judge Gettleman said, you know what, I'm reading this opinion as requiring additional discovery and evidence. And the FTC lawyer, and this is at pages 467 to 468 of the big appendix, said, no, Judge Gettleman, you're misreading. They were more polite than this, but they said, Judge Gettleman, you're misreading the Seventh Circuit's opinion. They're not requiring additional evidence. And then Judge Gettleman said to Mr. Trudeau's lawyers, okay, tell me what you want. Tell me what record development there needs to be. And that's at page 468. So Mr. Trudeau's lawyers on December 17th filed a brief. And he said at page 1, and this is document 277, Trudeau requests limited discovery and the opportunity to present additional evidence necessary to his defense against the new requested monetary sanctions. And he was talking about the whole notion of consumer harm, and the notion that the consumer harm remedy would be lessened if there was evidence that some of Mr. Trudeau's customers were satisfied with their purchase. At page 11 of document 277, Mr. Trudeau's lawyers wrote that if the district court chooses a consumer loss remedy, the Seventh Circuit, quote, indicated that Trudeau may present evidence that some customers who purchased the weight loss cure book were wholly satisfied with their purchase. Okay, that's the 17th. The FTC responds 4 days later in document 281 and repeats what it had said at the December 3rd hearing, which is no new evidence is required, no new discovery is required. Mr. Trudeau already had his chance the first time around. And then at the December 22nd hearing, Judge Gettleman said, you know what, I've changed my mind. I agree with the FTC. No more evidence. And he said it about five times. That was a long windup, but here's where there's the payoff in terms of Mr. Trudeau's knowledge. On January 19th, Mr. Trudeau's lawyers filed another brief, and that's document 284, where on page 4 they acknowledged that no new evidence was allowed, and at page 13 said, if we're permitted to introduce new evidence, we will show X, Y, and Z. So certainly Mr. Trudeau's lawyers knew that there was no new evidence allowed, in particular on the question of consumer harm and on whether any of his customers were satisfied with the book. Given this setup, could Judge Gettleman have reasonably found that Mr. Trudeau knew about this ruling? And the answer is yes. This was a big case. He was on the hook for tens of millions of dollars. One can assume that he was going to talk to his lawyers about this. And on the email blast and on his radio show and on his internet site, he said, I'm going to be in court next month. They want to fine me $50 million. No, wait a minute. They want to fine me $46 million. He knew exactly what was going on. He knew the state of play. And he said, what I'm saying isn't enough, apparently. I need evidence from you to prove that you weren't misled and that I helped you. And that's on pages 109 and 429 to 430 of the big appendix. He's asking his listeners to fill precisely the hole in the evidence that his lawyers argued was there on consumer harm. And Mr. Trudeau didn't front this with his lawyers. He just did it. And when you put all that together, there's an extremely strong circumstantial case. Certainly a reasonable person could find and certainly Judge Gettleman reasonably found, that Mr. Trudeau knew exactly what was going on, knew exactly what Judge Gettleman had said on December 22nd, and deliberately tried to do an end run around the ruling by having his followers directly send hundreds of emails into Judge Gettleman's judicial inbox.
Well, circling back a little bit to this urgency of the summary disposition on this, I think Judge Gettleman said something about if these were letters, I could just put them in a circular file, and we all know what that is. And aren't emails the same way? I mean, they're only bothersome until you open them up. Can't you just delete them as they come in, something like that, or have a spam filter or what have you so that you never even have to be exposed to them?
You know in advance. You could certainly divert the emails
but in terms of once it's happened, can't you put an immediate stop to it technologically and just look away from it?
Well, you can't look away from it, and Judge Gettleman found that this is an argument that Trudeau made at page 13 of his reply. He said Judge Gettleman could have deleted the emails without a threat assessment, and if there was a jaw dropper in the reply brief, that was it. Because, again, in this day and age, when you get a huge volume of emails with those kind of threats in them that we described at pages 9 to 10, you have to look at it. And Judge Gettleman articulated on no fewer than three occasions, pages 59, page 36, and page 31 of the big appendix, that he responded exactly as he was instructed to do by the Marshals Service. We have to stop everything and examine every type of communication that we get like this. The marshal suggested a threat assessment and that the emails are to be taken very seriously. I'm responding as we are instructed to respond to any type of potential situation like this. So the answer to your question is no. A judge in that situation does not have the ability to just ignore those emails, particularly given the context. And let's remember, this was not just Mr. Trudeau saying, hey, I'm in a bind. Will you guys help me out? Please send emails to Judge Gettleman. He both proceeded and followed his request with some very incendiary statements.
Yeah, now, of course, those weren't included in the emails, or obviously, I know you got them out in your brief, and they're really up front in your brief, but that was not part of the email communication, was it?
It was a direct result. The email communication was a direct result of what Mr. Trudeau asked. And he didn't just ask for help. He asked for help in a really angry way that was almost guaranteed to and did elicit an angry response from his followers. He began with an extreme...
No. Don't worry. Speak on.
When you tire of me, you'll let me know.
When
you tire of me, you'll let me know.
I just wanted to be even.
What Judge Gettleman found here was that Kevin Trudeau intentionally stirred up his followers to send angry emails, and that was on pages 38 to 39 of the big appendix. And the question is, was that a reasonable finding? And the answer is yes. Now,
you know, I guess what troubles me, when one thinks about being a judge, you might be doing that yourself at some point. You think,
like yesterday?
Yeah, like yesterday, I guess. But you think, okay, you've got a situation, you've got to deal with it. It seems to me perhaps Judge Gettleman jumped right to the summary process without consideration of the indirect process, which would have provided notice, procedures, defense, perhaps a jury if the penalty was going to be that great. It seems to me he jumped right to the sort of nuclear option.
And that's allowed by, I don't know if I call it the nuclear option, but that's allowed. Summary procedures are allowed. Bagwell,
but as a last choice, aren't they?
You could always, in retrospect, you could always step back and say, well, you know, should the judge have given notice and process under 42A as opposed to 42B? In retrospect, yes. But let's put ourselves back in Judge Gettleman's shoes.
And is the fact that, as he described Trudeau, a career contemnor, is that a factor in him jumping right to that summary disposition?
I don't think it's a big factor. I think what the judge had in front of him at that point was His communication system was impaired, and he was getting threatening emails, and he knew exactly what the source of that was. He knew exactly why they were sent. And when a litigant stops the judge from being able to do his job and causes followers, who, by the way, are not insusceptible to suggestion, to send 300 emails, many of which were angry and threatening, when a judge is faced with that, I think time is of the essence, and an immediate response is required.
Now, I can agree that the consequences of Mr. Trudeau's actions occurred in the court's presence, but the actions themselves seem to have occurred outside the presence of the court. I mean, he did this on the radio, on his own website, on his own email. Shouldn't we draw a distinction between the actions and the consequences for the purposes of Rule 42B? In other words, if we adopt your view, what happens if Trudeau's producer or a fan sends these things out under his name without his knowledge or consent? A judge who does not literally see the contemnor commit the act runs the risk of blaming a faultless person. And I know you're going to say, well, that's not what happened here, but I think we need to look at the big picture.
That's really what happened in Nye. The letter was sent, but the judge needed extrinsic evidence in order to know that Mr. Nye had prompted the litigant to send the letter. Here it was clear as a bell. There was no, and Judge Gettleman said, there's no extrinsic evidence necessary. We know what happened, and I can infer, I could find from the written record what's in front of me, what the intent was.
Would it have been any different if it had been letters instead of email?
Yes, it would have been different. Under the court's precedence, it would have been different. But email like Skype, provides an unmediated and an immediate means of communication.
I guess I don't see that, though. It's the letter comes in just the same way. You don't know what's in there until you open it up, unless there's something scrawled on the envelope or what have you. But it comes the same way. Judge could choose to have his mail delivered to the courtroom, I suppose.
Right, but a letter doesn't land. A letter can be stopped. A letter goes to the post office, and then it goes to the court's mail room, and then it goes to the judge's administrative assistant, and then it goes to the judge. It can be stopped.
The letter interferes with his computer.
Right. Here.
And it's basically saying that the computer is an extension of the judge.
It's exactly what
I'm
saying.
And therefore, the law is obsolete about proximity.
No, the law is not obsolete.
You can't say that a computer, because it can assimilate a lot of stuff, is proximate. I mean, when you look at the statute about something in the presence of, if you're saying something that interferes with a computer that happens to be in the presence of the judge, then that's the law you have to apply. And that's I think we would be greatly expanding the law if we say that's the way it works.
Let me give it a try. I think you would be applying the law that was set down in the late 19th century by the Supreme Court in Savin. What Savin said is the court is, quote, present in every part of the place set apart for its own use and for the use of its officers. The computer is set apart from the court's use. In the district court, at least all the district courts I've been in recently, the judge has a computer right there.
And he takes it with him. Everywhere he goes, then, is the courtroom.
Everywhere he goes where he's working, he is the courtroom.
Working nowadays, right?
Yeah.
Judicial work
You'll find out.
Judicial, perhaps. Judicial work gets done. You're working now, but you go back to your chambers and you may draft on a computer. You get votes on the computer. District judges get probation reports on the computer and statistics on the computer and communicates with the clerks on the computer and writes opinions on the computer and does research on the computer. The computer is part and parcel of the judicial toolbox as much as a gavel or a pen and paper.
So that in the presence, is everywhere. The judge is.
If the judge is doing judicial work. It's not. There's something that in the reply brief where Mr. Trudeau argued, well, what counts is if the judge is sitting on the bench, not just kicking back in chambers. And I'm paraphrasing there. That's not what they said. But when a judge is in chambers, I have to imagine the judge is working. If the judge is at his or her desk on the computer, that is part and parcel of the judicial function. And there are many judges who might not be able to operate, those who are more tech savvy, without electronic access on those computers. So to answer your question, Judge Manning, I think that Judge Gettleman found that the computer was an extension of himself, and that the computer is necessary for him to perform the judicial function. I think that finding is worthy of deference. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Feinerman. How are we? Where are we on time? How much? So 5 minutes now? Yeah. 5 minutes.
Thank you. A couple of brief rebuttal points. First, I'd like to address the Section 4013 argument that you just heard, arguing that Mr. Trudeau violated some order. Several points. First of all, Judge Gettleman, in his written contempt order issued February 17th, does not rely on or find a violation of Section 4013. He relies on Section 4011. To be sure, a week earlier, when we first appeared on him, he talked on the bench about his concerns. I immodestly hope I talked him out of it, because when he went, and I'll tell you why I don't think it was proper for him to rely on 4013, but in any event, when he writes up his formal contempt order on the 17th, which we're appealing, it relies exclusively under 4011, not 4013. Here's why I think Judge Gettleman, in good conscience and looking at, in fairness, at the record, could not and did not rely on Section 4013. First of all, there was no order ever entered that prevented anybody from submitting additional evidence. We did have a discussion on the record with the judge about whether he was going to allow more discovery or not. He went back and forth. After that discussion, he left in place an order allowing for additional discovery. He never rescinded that. Secondly, before Mr. Trudeau got on the radio and encouraged his supporters, the FTC itself had lobbed in additional evidence in one of their reply briefs. They submitted additional evidence. And so they obviously didn't think that there was an unequivocal command of the court forbidding any additional evidence. One construction of the judge's comments, oral comments, is was he not going to let any more depositions or interrogatories, kind of Rule 33 or Rule 34 or Rule 30 discovery. In fact, that's how I interpreted it. I assume that's how the FTC counsel interpreted it, because they didn't take any more depositions, but they lobbed in a lot more correspondence and extrinsic evidence in their brief, and they did it before Mr. Trudeau. The difference is Mr. Trudeau gets sent off to the pokey for 30 days, and they're not. They're sitting here in the courtroom today. And so I don't think they viewed this as an unequivocal command.
He's not in any pokies.
Well, he was ordered to report in 24 hours to the pokey until this court stayed the sentence. So he's certainly under the threat of that. In any event, my point is that even the FTC counsel didn't think that there was some unequivocal command. And furthermore, the point was made here that Mr. Trudeau wasn't in court. He wasn't the subject of an in-court unequivocal command, and that's what the jurisprudence in this area indicates is required for there to be criminal contempt. And finally, even if this was somehow submitting additional evidence in violation of an oral comment from the judge is somehow punishable under Section 4013, which I don't believe it is, it's certainly not subject to summary punishment and sentencing under Rule 42B, which is what the judge here did. And it's not, because, as I've said before, that summary procedure is limited to the very narrow situation where the misbehavior occurs in the presence of the court. So even this is a point the amicus doesn't even address. They go on and on about Rule 413, but no way can you can you drive that into Rule 42B for summary procedure? And I want to make another point about this whole immediacy thing, the immediacy issue. Mr. Fineman, minutes ago, just conceded that in retrospect, the judge could have handled it with more due process procedures and didn't have to do it under Rule 42B, and I think that's a fatal concession here under the Supreme Court jurisdiction. The judge's staff called me at 4 o'clock on Wednesday, February 10, and said, you need to be in court the following morning at 10 o'clock. I said, what is it about? There's nothing scheduled. They refused to tell me. I show up at 10 o'clock, and the judge says, well, I got all these emails. My BlackBerry at the university is going off and on and off. We're going to do something about it. Bring your client in here at 1 o'clock the same day, 3 hours later. He says, we're going to have a rule to show cause hearing. I get Mr. Trudeau. In the meantime, we've seized all emails, okay? I told him, cut it out. No more emails. He apologizes on the Internet. He tells his supporter, don't send any more emails. We show up at 1 o'clock for a rule to show cause hearing, and there's no hearing at all. Judge Gutterman came out on the bench, and before we said anything, he says, I hereby fine Mr. Trudeau in criminal contempt of court. So there was no hearing, and I think in retrospect there was really no reason for this immediacy. And in fact, had they told me what it was all about at 4 o'clock, pretty sure we could have eliminated the annoyance of the judge's BlackBerry going off. And one final point on this whole virtual presence, you just heard the amicus argue that the statute ought to be rewritten to really eviscerate the physical geographic limitation and substitute in thereof a virtual presence. So a judge can be looking at his or her BlackBerry, looking at official business on the French Riviera, and if they see something offensive, it's now punishable, in their view, summarily under Section 401. That blows a hole in the statute and runs squarely in the face of Nye and Wilson. That completes my remarks. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Well, thanks to all parties. Thanks to Sidley and Austin for taking on this responsibility for the court and doing just such a fine job for your clients. And thanks as well to Mr. Anderson and the firm of Winston and Strawn for the fine job they did. The case will be taken under advisement, and there will be a 5 or 10 minute recess before the next case, so everyone else in the courtroom can go wild.